sticks are prophecies against Judah, Isaiah's own nation. Chapters 1 through 6, prophecies against Judah. Chapters 7 through 12, an equal length, six more chapters, 7 through 12, are prophecies against the nation of Israel to the north, predicting their destruction by Assyria. That's 7 through 12. That's section, that's part 2 of section 1. The third portion is chapters 13 through 23. This section could be called the burdens, or the burdens of the nations, because these 11 chapters, with the exception of one of them, chapter 22, are burdens against Gentile nations round about. Chapter 22 is against Jerusalem, but it's also a burden. The burden against Babylon, the burden against Philistia, the burden against Edom, the burden against Moab, and so forth. These are prophecies of judgment against, in all cases except one, against pagan nations. But Jerusalem is thrown in there right in the midst of them as if it too is of the status of a pagan nation. Chapters 13 through 23 we can call the burdens against the nations. The fourth segment would be chapters 24 through 27. Chapters 24 through 27, I'm going to hold off on giving that a name at this point. Mark it and I'll give you a name in a moment for it. Okay, that's the fourth. The fifth segment is chapters 28 through 33. Chapters 28 through 33 we would call the woes. Now, there's a reason for that, of course. There's a reason for everything. Chapters 28 through 33 have this in common. All of those chapters, all six of them, except for one of them, chapter 32, they all begin with the word woe. Chapters 28 through 33, six chapters, all begin with the word woe, with one exception. Chapter 32 does not. But that section we would call the woes. Then we have the sixth segment is chapter 34 and 35. Now, I said I'd hold off and giving you a title for the fourth section, which is chapters 24 through 27. I believe that chapters 24 through 27 and chapters 34 and 35, which is the sixth segment here, are both about the same thing as each other. These are, it's hard to know how to name them. Some would call it judgment and blessing. Judgment followed by blessing is the theme of both these sections. I would be a little more specific in naming them. I believe that these sections predict the transition from the old order to the new order. That is, from the old covenant era to the new covenant era. These passages talk about, in my understanding, they talk about the destruction of the old order, including the Jewish war and the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD, and they talk about the institution of a new order, the Messianic kingdom, which I take to be fulfilled in the church. So these are chapters about transition from the old order to the new order. And it is a major theme in Isaiah, but these sections focus entirely upon it. There are shorter sections within the others, passages and so forth that talk about the same thing. But the fourth segment, which is chapters 24 through 27, and the sixth segment, which are chapters 34 and 35, both of them are about this transition from the old order to the new order, from the old covenant to the new. All right? Now, the seventh portion of the Book of Judgment is chapters 36 through 39. I've already mentioned these chapters. These are historical in nature. They're not prophetic. They are simply a retelling of a historic period that was already covered in the book of 2 Kings. They tell, for example, of the siege of Jerusalem and of the angel delivering Jerusalem when Hezekiah prayed to God. They also tell of Hezekiah's sickness from which he recovered and of his subsequent visit from emissaries from Babylon who came to congratulate him for his recovery. Those chapters correspond almost word for word with similar chapters in the book of 2 Kings. We could call that a historical interlude, or I'd actually refer to that as a historical transition. And the reason for that is it closes the first book and opens, or leads us up to ready for the opening of the next book. And this historical transition has this interesting feature. We're talking now about chapters 36 through 39. There are four chapters there. The first two concern themselves with the Assyrian threat. The Assyrian threat. When Assyria besieged Jerusalem in the days of Hezekiah. The other two chapters, 38 and 39, introduce a much later threat under the Babylonians. We can say the Babylonian threat. And in chapter 39, Isaiah has to tell Hezekiah that because he made the foolish move of showing all the treasures of Jerusalem to the Babylonians, that the Babylonians would someday, not in Hezekiah's own day, but someday come and take them all away. And that's how chapter 39 ends. So in 36 and 37, we've got the Assyrians are the threat in view. In chapters 38 and 39, the Babylonian threat is introduced, that the Babylonians are going to take the Jews into captivity, and that's how the book of Judgment ends, with that historical interlude or transition. Now, the reason I call it a transition is this, that the prophecies of the first portion of Isaiah are all about the Assyrian period. The Assyrians' threat to Jerusalem. But when you get to the Book of Comfort, chapters 40 through 27, 40 through 66, 27 chapters, in that section, the time frame is very different, which is one reason for people denying that Isaiah wrote both sections. Because the time frame of chapters 40 through 66 is the time of the Babylonian captivity. Of the Babylonians having taken Israel in, or Judah into captivity, and much of the prophecies there are about the restoration of the captives from Babylon. Now, that didn't happen until over 100 years after Isaiah's own time. Which means that if Isaiah wrote those chapters, which I'm convinced he did, that he was carried away in vision to a time 100 years beyond his own time, even as John, you know, in Patmos, by vision, was carried into the future to see things as if they were happening before his eyes, which were not really part of his own lifetime, some of them. Maybe some of them were. But the idea being that Isaiah was carried forward into a period 100 years beyond his own time, and where he speaks in the prophetic perfect tense as if Jerusalem is already in captivity in Babylon, and he speaks of the restoration of the Jews from Babylon, even mentioning Cyrus, the Persian, who conquered Babylon and delivered the Jews from it by name. Now, because of this different historical setting of chapters 40 through 66, this is one reason that some people think Isaiah didn't write those chapters, but I believe he did, and I'll tell you why I believe he did in a few moments. But just so you'll know, the threat to Judah in the first part of Isaiah is Assyria. The threat and the enemy of Judah in the second part from chapter 40 on is Babylon. And the historical interlude in chapters 36 through 39 it provide a transition, focusing first on the Assyrian threat and how God dealt with that, and secondly, introducing the Babylonian threat. Because when Hezekiah showed all the treasures of Jerusalem to the Babylonian messengers, Isaiah said, well, someday they're all going to come and take them all away, referring to the Babylonian captivity. So we have in chapters 36 through 39 an historical interlude there, which provides a transition from the first part of the book of Judgment, to the second part, which is the book of Consolation. Before I go on to describing the sections of the book of Consolation, everyone understand that? You need a repeat of any of that? Seven portions of the first segment. Prophecies against Judah in the first six chapters. Prophecy against Israel in the next six, up through chapter 12, 7 through 12. Burdens against pagan nations in chapters 13 through 23. And then a prophecy of the transition from the old order into the new order in chapters 24 through 27. The six chapters of woes in chapters 28 through 33. Another segment talking about the transition from the old order to the new in chapters 34 and 35. And then the remaining chapters, 36 through 39, are a historical transition, closing down the prophecies relevant to the Assyrian period and introducing a setting for the prophecies of the Babylonian period. And that brings us to the Book of Comfort, chapters 40 through 66, which, as I said earlier, in many ways seem to correspond with the New Testament in content. In fact, interestingly, chapter 40 begins with the prophecy of John the Baptist. Chapter 40, verses 3 through 5, a voice of one crying in the wilderness, make straight the way of the Lord. Isaiah was prophesying John the Baptist. And four Gospels mention this prophecy as being about John the Baptist. Isaiah 66 closes with a discussion about the new heavens and the new earth, which is how Revelation closes. This book of comfort begins the same way the New Testament begins, with the ministry of John the Baptist, and ends the same way the New Testament ends, with a description of the new heavens and the new earth. Isn't that interesting? And in the exact center is Isaiah 53, the prophecy of Jesus, very clearly his suffering and death and resurrection. Now, in addition to those general observations, I'd point out to you that the book of Consolation, chapters 40 through 66, itself divides into three subsections, and these are of equal length. They are 9 chapters long each. These 27 chapters divide into 3 segments of equal length. And this division also is not artificial, but it is punctuated by the book itself. If you'll look at the end of Isaiah 48, that's the end of the first 9 chapters of this section. Isaiah 48, verse 22, the last verse in that chapter, the last verse in the first 9 chapters of this segment. It says, "There is no peace, says the Lord, for the wicked." Now, go 9 chapters further to the end of Isaiah 57. The last verse there, Isaiah 57:21. "There is no peace, says my God, for the wicked." The same refrain. Now, it's, I think, no accident that this same refrain is found in these two spots. If it is seen as a punctuating point, as a summary statement of what precedes it, it divides these 27 chapters into segments of 9 chapters each. The first 9 chapters end with this statement, "There's no peace, says the Lord, for the wicked." The next 9 chapters end with the same statement, and then there's 9 more chapters. To make it perfect, we should hope to see it as the last verse of chapter 66 as well, which it is not. Don't bother looking, it's not there. However, this is, I think, interesting. I think it provides some insight into the intentional division of the book. Now, the first 9 of these chapters, chapters 40 through 48, principally focus on a man named Cyrus, who was the Persian conqueror of Babylon. After the Jews had spent their 70 years in Babylon, Cyrus conquered Babylon and released the Jews, enabling them to go back home. In the middle of this section, Cyrus is mentioned by name, 150 years before his birth, 200 years before he actually delivered the people. But it predicts that he will do this, and it calls him by name in Isaiah 44 near the end of that chapter, and chapter 45 at the beginning, right in the middle here. Cyrus is mentioned throughout the section, not always by name, but the deliverance of the Jews from Babylon is clearly what is in view in these 9 chapters, 40 through 48. The next 9 chapters, which are chapters 49 through 57, are about the Messiah, of whom Cyrus was a type. Cyrus, who delivered the Jews from Babylon, is a type of the Messiah who will deliver his people from their sins. And just as Cyrus was mentioned by name in the exact middle of that section about him, so the Messiah is mentioned in the exact middle of chapters 49 through 47, which is Isaiah 53, which I mentioned earlier. That's the center not only of the 27 chapters, but of the middle 9. Which are principally about the Messiah. We will say this is called, this section will call it the servant of Jehovah. That is the term that is used for the Messiah, and we'll have much to say about the use of that term when we come to those passages, because it's an Isaianic term that is that will repay some study. So the second 9 chapters are about the servant of Jehovah, the Messiah, and of course the very center of those chapters is the famous chapter 53. The last 9 chapters, chapters 58 through 66, we would say are about the golden age of the Messiah, which I take to be the church age. Of course, premillennialists take it about the millennium. But in any case, it's the messianic kingdom. So this is how the book divides. Quite indisputably, it divides into 2 major sections, 1 through 39 and 40 through 66 are the 2 major sections. These correspond to the number of books in the Old Testament and the New Testament, respectively. whether coincidentally or by design, is, you know, we could argue, but we'll never know. The first 39 chapters divide into 7 subsections, and the last 27 chapters divide into 3 of equal length. And that is all you need to know about the structure. That will help you to know where you are at any given time in reading the book and knowing essentially what the subject matter is in each section. Now, the final thing we need to concern ourselves with is the authorship of the Book of Consolation, the last 27 chapters. Or, to give it a more of a common title, the unity of the Book of Isaiah. When people talk about the unity of Isaiah, of course they're talking about the question of whether it is one book written by one man, or whether it's a conglomeration of books written by more than one man. Now, why would we even suggest that there's more than one author of the Book of Isaiah? Well, until this century, no one denied that Isaiah, the son of Amos, who lived in the days of Ahaz and Hezekiah, wrote the whole book. No one ever denied it. Strong tradition and and all kinds of evidence seemed to point that direction. But in modern times, in this century, a number of critical scholars began to say, well, Isaiah, the son of Amos, did write the first 39 chapters, but he couldn't have written chapters 40 through 66. And the reasons they gave were as follows. First of all, the setting, as I mentioned, of chapters 40 through 66 seems to be a different time period than that of Isaiah. The assumption throughout these chapters is that the Jews are in Babylon, and the predictions are that they will return from Babylon, that God will deliver them from Babylon. Okay? Now, since Isaiah did not live at the time when the Jews were in Babylon, and the whole language of chapters 40 through 66 seems to presuppose their presence there, it is argued it must have been written at a later time in history than the time of Isaiah. Now, the answer to that I gave was that he was carried forward in vision to that time and wrote as if he was in that time. That is not uncommon in the prophets for them to speak in the prophetic perfect tense, as it, you know, they're caught up in vision to see something as if it were happening then, and they speak of it as if it were present, although in history it has not yet occurred. But it is said that the time frame of those chapters is different than Isaiah's time. And another objection they have is that the prophecies of the restoration in this section from Babylon, and particularly the specific mention of Cyrus by name, preclude the possibility of Isaiah having written it, since Isaiah could never have known these particulars, they say. Remember, liberals don't believe in the miraculous. They hardly believe in God. Some of them don't even believe in God. Therefore, they do not believe that such a phenomenon as predictive prophecy of a man actually having accurate and truly revealed information about the future from God, they don't believe that's a possibility. That's just one of the things that liberals think. They don't believe that there is anything like genuine predictive prophecy or miracles. Both predictive prophecy and miracles are supernatural phenomena, and liberals are largely anti-supernaturalists. So the fact that Cyrus is mentioned by name and other details of the return of the exiles from Babylon 200 years before their fulfillment, to them that's the death knell against any theory that Isaiah could have written it. How could Isaiah have known such things? It must have been written by someone later who was contemporary with Cyrus, or else how could he name him like that? And so the time frame and the specificity of the predictions argue for a later writer, they say, at a later time. Add to this the fact that Isaiah's name is mentioned many times in the first 39 chapters, but his name is not mentioned in chapters 40 through 66. None of those chapters name Isaiah as their author, nor as contemporary with him. His name doesn't even appear in those chapters. And so these considerations provided the principal reason for denying that Isaiah, the son of Amos, wrote those chapters. Now, they didn't know who did write them. It is assumed that the author is unknown, that Isaiah, the son of Amos, did write chapters 1 through 39, but the author of chapters 40 through 66 is some unknown guy. His name was not preserved. Somehow his works were combined with the works of Isaiah later on, but they were not the works of Isaiah. Therefore, in order to know how to speak of this author, since they don't know his name, they call him Second Isaiah. Not because they think his name was Isaiah, but his work is attached to the book of Isaiah, but they don't think he's the same Isaiah. He's another guy. And for lack of knowing his real name, they simply call him Second Isaiah. Well, once the liberals get started on this kind of stuff, there's no end to it. just like they did to the Pentateuch, and dividing it into first two traditions, then three, then four, and so forth. So have they done with Isaiah. Many scholars have gone on to talk about not only Deutero-Isaiah, which is second Isaiah, but Trito-Isaiah, third Isaiah as well. That is, they're finding evidence of a third author as well as a second author. And some have gone so far as to find 7, 10, or far more. In fact, there's some who'd almost give a different author to every chapter, which is an absurdity, of course, but this is the absurdity which one is driven to when one begins to make arbitrary decisions about authorship based on very wrong assumptions in the first place. Now, in favor of the authorship of Isaiah being one man, or what we call the unity of the book of Isaiah, all written by one man, we have many things in favor of this supposition. Not the least of which is that no one ever doubted that Isaiah wrote the whole book until this century. And certainly scholars of the Bible, including Jewish scholars, even before the time of Christ, were aware that chapters 40 through 66 are markedly different in character than those of the first 39 chapters, but they never saw this as an argument against Isaiah having written them. It is, in fact, the secularist mood of our academic age that compels people to reject Isaiah's authorship of them. Their assumption that there is no such thing as predictive prophecy and nothing miraculous, nothing supernatural ever occurs. It is that philosophical assumption of naturalism that basically, as opposed to supernaturalism, that compels them to make this denial. But there are many things in favor of the Isaianic authorship. Among them are external evidences and internal evidences. Let me talk first about the internal evidences within the book itself. There's a lot of these. First of all, the vocabulary of the book argues for one author of the whole book. There are 25 words in the Hebrew, or forms of words, that are unique to the book of Isaiah. That means they're not found anywhere else in the Old Testament except in the book of Isaiah. But these words are used throughout the whole book, both sections. Now, what that means is, of course, we know that Isaiah, who wrote the first 39 chapters, used these 25 words. No other known Old Testament writer used any of these words, but the writer of the last 27 chapters also used the same words, which argues for one consistent book written by a man with the same vocabulary, which was different from the vocabulary of other prophets. These are Isaianic words, and they're found in both the first and the second segments of the book. One of the key expressions in Isaiah that is found in both sections of the book is the name for God, or the title for God, the Holy One of Israel. The Holy One of Israel is a term used for God 12 times in the first 39 chapters. And 14 times in the last 27 chapters. And outside of Isaiah, this expression is found only 6 times in the Old Testament. In all the combined writings of the Old Testament, God is called the Holy One of Israel only 6 times outside of Isaiah. But 12 times in Isaiah 1 through 39, and 14 times in Isaiah 20, the last 27 chapters of Isaiah. Now, that makes it a distinctively Isaianic term for God, and it's very thick through both sections of Isaiah, again arguing for a unity of authorship. That's a vocabulary consideration. Now, there's also the consideration of dominant themes in the book. There are certain themes that Isaiah uses that are introduced in the early parts and are carried out in the later parts, so that you get the impression that the same author is writing both sections. Let me give you a list of these and some references to them. Now, I'm only going to give... Many of these themes are found repeatedly throughout the book, but I'm going to give you only one or two references from each segment of each theme so you can see that it's found in both parts. First of all, the reference to God's judgment on the nation of Israel, or Judah, is said to be... It's likened to fire. Unquenchable fire is the term that is used. If you'll notice chapter 1, verse 31, in a prophecy against the nation of Judah, Isaiah 1:31 says, "The strong shall be as tinder, and the work of it as a spark. Both will burn together, and no one shall quench them." Okay? the spark, the fire of God's judgment against Judah will be something that no one will quench. Look at chapter 66, which is obviously at the end of the second section of the book. And the last verse, chapter 66, verse 24. And they shall go forth and look upon the corpses of the men who have transgressed against me, for their worm does not die and their fire is not quenched. They shall be an abhorrence to all flesh. So Isaiah, speaking of the destruction of Judah in one case, in chapter 1, speaks of them having burning with a fire that is not quenched. Likewise, in the second segment, in chapter 66, verse 24, the unquenchable fire is also mentioned in connection with the judgment of that nation. Another theme that's brought up in the first section and carried out in the second, and has many other places throughout the book that are mentioned, is the theme of the nation being sick and in need of a healer, figuratively speaking. In chapter 1, verses 5 and 6, it says, "Why should you be stricken again? You will revolt more and more. The whole head is sick. The whole heart faints. From the sole of the foot even to the head, there's no soundness in it. The nation is compared to a man, sick from head to toe. No soundness, but wounds and bruises and putrefying sores, they have not been closed or bound up or soothed with ointment. No one has treated these wounds. The nation is sick, and there's no healer for the nation." However, if you turn to the second section in the Book of Consolation, in Isaiah 53, verses 4 and 5, it says, "Surely he has borne our griefs," can be translated sicknesses, "and carried our sorrows," which can be translated pains. "Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God and afflicted, but he was wounded for our transgressions, he was bruised for our iniquities, the chastisement for our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed." Now, the nation is seen in chapter 1 as if it were a sick man, sick from head to toe, needing someone to bind it up to heal it, but no one's there to do it. However, in the second segment, the Messiah appears, and he's there to bring healing to the nation, and by his stripes and by his sacrifice of himself. So the theme is introduced in the first section, completed in the second section. Another theme that is found in both segments is a reference to all the Gentiles someday flowing into the holy mountain of the house of the Lord. This theme is repeatedly mentioned. Just let me give you examples from the first and second segments to show that it's in both parts. Chapter 2, verse 2 says, "Now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow to it." Now, all nations are going to flow to the mountain of the Lord's house, to the holy mountain. This idea is brought up again and again, but not only in the first segment, but also in the second. It's carried out in chapter 56 and verse 7. Chapter 56, verse 7, it says, "Even them," meaning the Gentile nations, "will I bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer." Okay? And then in chapter 66 and verse 20. Chapter 66, verse 20, "Then they shall bring all your brethren for an offering to the Lord out of all nations on horses and in chariots and litters and mules and camels to my holy mountain, Jerusalem." Now, the Gentiles coming in large numbers to the holy mountain is introduced in chapter 2, but it's carried out throughout the rest of the book, including to the end of the book. Chapter 66 has the same theme. Another theme that's found throughout Isaiah, both in both segments, is the theme of God constructing a highway to Zion. This is figurative, but it's nonetheless a figure that's used throughout the book. In Isaiah 11:16, Isaiah 11:16 says, "There will be a highway for the remnant of his people who will be left from Assyria." Okay, a highway for them to travel on. This highway is mentioned a number of other times. For example, in chapter 40, verses 3 through 5, "The voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare a highway for our God in the wilderness." That's in the second segment of the book. And you'll find half a dozen or more other references in Isaiah to this highway that God makes. There's more. Some are exact verbal parallels. In Isaiah 11, 6 through 9, it says, "The wolf shall also dwell with the lamb. The leopard shall lie down with the young goat. The calf and the young lion fatling together. The little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze. Their young ones shall lie down together. And the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play by the cobra's hole. And the weaned child put his hand on the viper's den. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. For the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea." This picture is found, of course, here in the first section. It's also found in the second, in chapter 65 and verse 25. Chapter 65, verse 25. says, the wolf and the lamb shall feed together, the lion shall eat straw like the ox, the dust shall be the serpent's food, and they shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, says the Lord. A shorter form of the same thing, but verbally the same. Both places. In chapter 11, verse 12, it says, he will set up a banner for the nations, and will assemble the outcasts of Israel, and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. This banner for the nations, he's setting up a banner around which the nations will rally. Well, this is found, of course, here in Isaiah 11, 12, but it's also found in the other part of Isaiah. In chapter 49, verse 22, it says, thus says the Lord God, behold, I will lift up my hand in an oath to the nations, and set up my standard, which means banner, for the peoples. Okay, so he sets up a banner or a standard to the peoples. Again in Isaiah 62, 10. Go through the gates. Prepare the way of the people. Build up the highway. There's that highway again. Take up the stones. Lift up a banner for the peoples. There's the banner again. These themes begin in the early part, and they run all the way through. And I'm only giving you a few examples of each one. There's many others, examples of the same. That last reference was chapter 66, verse 10. Now, there's more of these. I'm looking at the clock saying I can't give you all of them right now, but these are the kinds of things you find. These themes that are found in both segments. Yes, Adam? That one was 62:10. Did I say 66?
Yeah.
Sorry about that. Oh, okay, 62:10. Sorry. 62:10 was that last reference. Now, these are a few of the many themes. I have actually about twice as many here listed, but those will serve to show that not only the vocabulary, but the themes of the first section are found throughout the whole book, even through the second section, giving the impression that one man is using all of them. Now, most importantly, the New Testament quotes Isaiah by name over 20 times. Now, it also quotes Isaiah without mentioning his name even more times. But there are about 20 times in the New Testament that New Testament writers quote from the book of Isaiah and mention, Isaiah said this. Their quotations come from both the first and the second part of Isaiah. And that means, of course, that New Testament writers attribute quotations from the first 39 chapters, they attribute them to Isaiah. They also attribute quotations from the last 27 chapters to the same man, to Isaiah. An example of this is that Matthew, for example, quotes Isaiah by name six times. I won't give you the references now, it'll take too long to give them, but six times in Matthew, Isaiah is quoted by name. Three of the quotes come from the first section of Isaiah, and the other three come from the second section of Isaiah. So Isaiah is quoted, both sections are quoted equally in Matthew, and Matthew says Isaiah was the speaker in every case. Another interesting example is in John chapter 12, where Isaiah is quoted twice within the space of a couple of verses, twice in succession, and one quote comes from the first segment and one from the second segment. In John 12, verses 38 through 41, John wrote that the word of Isaiah the prophet might be fulfilled, which he spoke, Lord, who has believed our report? To whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? That's a quote from Isaiah 53:1. Therefore they could not believe, because Isaiah said again, he has blinded their eyes and hardened their heart, lest they should see with their eyes and understand with their heart, lest they should turn so that I should heal them. Now, that quote is from Isaiah 6. So John quotes from Isaiah 53, which is part of the book of consolation, and from Isaiah 6, which is part of the book of judgment, and in both places he says, Isaiah said, and Isaiah said again. And then in verse 41 he summarizes these things, both of them, Isaiah said when he saw his glory and spoke of him. So Isaiah saw the glory of Christ and spoke of him, and quotes come from both portions of Isaiah, and both of them are said to be by Isaiah. Now, there's another couple of considerations. Now you might say, well, what's the big deal? Why spend so much time on this? Because virtually every modern academic writer on Isaiah assumes Isaiah did not write the whole book. It's just one of those politically correct kind of things, academically correct fads. You just don't accept the unity of Isaiah if you want to be respectable in biblical scholarship. And that, of course, raises questions as to whether one should be respectable in biblical scholarship. If being respectable means you have to follow every apostate fad in theology and biblical studies, then I'd say it's just as well not to be very respectable in that crowd. But it is nonetheless true. You will find pastors, you'll find commentators, even conservative commentators that hedge on this. I've been disappointed to find F.F. Bruce, who's generally a conservative commentator, in speaking of quotations from the Book of Comfort, to simply say the writer of Isaiah 40 through 66, without committing himself to saying it was Isaiah who wrote it. That's a shame. Because you see, the whole reason for denying it is a denial of predictive prophecy. One of the most important proofs that the prophets could see the future is the fact that Isaiah, living in the days of Hezekiah, could predict by name what Cyrus would do 200 years later. But if we reject the unity of the book of Isaiah, we rob ourselves of that particular proof of inspiration, and there's not a good reason to do so. By the way, if the book is not a unity, if in fact there were two authors of the different sections, a couple of things are hard to explain. One is, how is it that the best writing in the Old Testament, which is found in the Book of Consolation, all agree the best poetry, the finest prophecies, the most lofty visions in the whole Bible, in the Old Testament at least, are found in Isaiah chapters 40 through 66. How is it that the best prophetic writings, we don't even know who wrote them? I mean, somehow this great writer of the Jews remains anonymous, and the Jews don't remember who he was because they accidentally attached him to Isaiah's book without retaining any knowledge of who the real guy was. When you consider that a guy like Obadiah, who wrote only one chapter against Edom, his prophecy is remembered by name, how could the writer of the finest prophecies in the Bible have managed to have his name forgotten and have his work attached anonymously and mistakenly for some other prophet who lived 100 years earlier than his time? That's a question hard to answer. It seems very unlikely that this would be true, because that's the scenario you'd have to paint. That if indeed Isaiah did not write chapters 40 through 66, then we have to assume that somebody whose name has been forgotten, whose name has been lost, wrote those wonderful chapters, and the Jews just didn't think it important to remember who he was. Even the generation that was his contemporaries didn't put his name down, although they retained the names of much less important prophets like Obadiah and Habakkuk and Zephaniah and so forth. Another consideration is this. After critical scholarship had come up with this theory of more than one author of Isaiah, they found the Dead Sea Scrolls. And of course the Dead Sea Scrolls have the whole Old Testament in them, including Isaiah, and so they were eager to look and see whether these two sections of Isaiah were preserved in the same scroll or not. Because the Dead Sea Scrolls date from 1,000 years ago, and it was thought perhaps back then it was well known that there were different authors of these two portions, and therefore you might find the first 39 chapters in one scroll and the last 27 chapters in another. Well, not only did they find all of Isaiah in one scroll, but what's of interest is that chapter 39 ended near the bottom of a page, and only one line of chapter 40 was written below that, and then it continued on up there. In other words, they didn't recognize any division. It would have been quite natural if they recognized chapter 40 to start a new book or by a new author. You know, especially since chapter 39 almost came to the bottom of a page, it would be a natural place for them to break it off and then start a new page with chapter 40 if they thought of it as a separate document. But instead, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, chapter 39 ends one line from the bottom of the page, and chapter 40 begins on that last line and then continues on to the next, showing no evidence that the writers of the Dead Sea Scrolls had any clue or any theory that those chapters were written by some different author. They just saw it as a unity. And if they thought that 1,000 years ago, and if all the Jews even closer to Isaiah's time who preserved it thought so, how could anyone living in the 20th century, some 1,700 years after Isaiah's time, feel like they have on this scant evidence reason to reject wholesale the authorship of the second portion being that of Isaiah? First of all, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't agree with the vocabulary of both sections, the thematic evidence. It doesn't agree with the quotes from the New Testament, including Jesus himself. You know, I mean, basically we have to decide in favor of the New Testament authority or in favor of the critical scholars who are against New Testament authority on this matter. So obviously I have no respect for critical authority on this, and we have to, on New Testament authority, accept that Isaiah wrote the whole thing, and there's every good reason internally from evidence and externally in the Dead Sea Scrolls and everywhere else. Even logic itself tells us that those chapters were not written by some unknown anonymous guy. They are part of the book of Isaiah, always have been, because they were written by the same author. All right, next time we will, of course, get into the book of Isaiah. I don't know if I'll be able to. I'm hoping to make a handout for you. In fact, I hope to give it to you before the day is over, but that's maybe not possible. But I'd like for you to pray.